Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. The United States is experiencing a pendulum swing in end-of-life care. In 1945, the average American died at home. By the late 1990s, our average had reversed, and 83% of us were dying in institutions. That trend reversed again in recent years, and now 45% of us are dying with the aid of hospice care. Atul Gawande's latest book, Being Mortal, delves into the ethics and realities of how we deal with death and dying. In it, he weighs the physician's goal to cure and keep people alive against the patient's interest in living with dignity and choice. Here, Gawande explores ways that physicians and caregivers might enhance our lives, even at the end. Atul Gawande is a best-selling author, a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and a professor at Harvard. Town Hall Seattle and University Bookstore presented this event on October 20th, 2014, as part of the Civics series. Sponsors included the Boeing Company, the Real Networks Foundation, and the True Brown Foundation. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for this recording.
Here to introduce tonight's guest, please welcome Dr. Randy Curtis, Director of the Palliative Care Center at the University of Washington.
Thank you very much, and good evening. As you heard, I have the great honor of directing the Palliative Care Center of Excellence at the University of Washington and UW-Madison. The Palliative Care Center of Excellence started about 2 years ago, actually exactly 2 years ago, and has really accomplished a lot in its short 2 years, in large part through great support from UW-Madison, the University of Washington, and others, including the Cambia Health Foundation. And we've really been able to ride a wave of interest in this topic. And so it's a great honor for us to be able to co-sponsor this event and for me to be able to introduce Dr. Atul Gawande. Dr. Gawande is a surgeon, a writer, and a public health researcher. He practices general and endocrine surgery at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. And he's a professor in both the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Department of Surgery at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Gawande has been a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he has written about health and medicine since 1998. He's the author of three best-selling books, including the 2002 National Book Award finalist, Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. I had the opportunity to meet Dr. Gawande when I made a visit to Harvard Medical School and to Brigham and Women's Hospital. I was being recruited to direct a research center at Harvard Medical School on palliative care. And I was incredibly impressed by Dr. Gawande, who in our short meeting wasn't interested in my research credentials, my publications, or my methods, but looked me straight in the eye and said, "What are the really big questions? What do we need to answer to be able to make people's lives better?" Tonight, he joins us to discuss his latest book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. And in this book, he tackles some really big questions. He tackles the difficult subjects of death, dying, and the kind of care we want to give to the elderly, especially at the end. And he asks if there might be a better way, one that involves us taking a more honest look at our own mortality. Please join me in a warm welcome for Dr. Atul Gawande.
Thank you. That's awesome. That's good. This is just such a beautiful place. Thank you all for coming out. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. And welcoming me back 4 years ago, I got to be here, and it was just so amazing. I want to talk to you a little bit about what I didn't learn in medical school. The very first line of my book is that I learned about a lot of things in medical school, but mortality wasn't one of them, which is odd when you think about it. But we conceived our job as being, and you know, I went into medicine because I wanted to be a hero. I wanted to learn how to save lives. But unexpectedly, when I got into practice, I found as much time was spent seeing people whose problems I could not cure, I could not fix, as spending time with people who I could. I do cancer surgery and general surgery, and whether it was chronic illness, frailty, terminal illness, those were the problems where people were asking me questions that I wasn't all that equipped to be able to ask. And they came in a variety of ways. They'd come in my office, sometimes from neighbors, sometimes from friends. I want to tell you about one call that was an example of this. It came from the husband of Peg Batchelder, my 13-year-old daughter's piano teacher. And her husband, Martin, called saying, "Peg is in the hospital." She'd been diagnosed a few years back with cancer. It was misdiagnosed for a couple of years. She had a hip pain. People couldn't explain it very well. Somebody began to even say, you know, maybe it's just really in your head and you need to see a psychiatrist and just learn how to live with this. But then it advanced and advanced until it became clear it was a 5-centimeter, sort of 2-inch sized sarcoma, as it's called, a soft tissue cancer, rare cancer in the pelvis. And in order to treat it, she had to go through removal of 1/3 of her pelvis in a difficult operation, then chemotherapy, then radiation. She had multiple complications along the way. She called it her year in hell. She'd had to stop teaching. She was an avid bicyclist, yoga practitioner, and that had to be set aside. But she got through it. There was no evidence of disease anymore. And she returned to building up her roster of students again. And she filled her roster in no time. She was in her early 60s, this tall, lovely woman who had this very gentle way about her when she taught. She was this warm, enthusiastic presence for her students who would push them and push them. But I could see with my daughter Hunter that, you know, she would sort of thrill with delight when Hunter would get it right and give her a hug and let her know, this is great. And that brought her all kinds of folks. 3 years after being back, however, she ended up being diagnosed with a complication of her chemotherapy. She'd formed a leukemia-like malignancy that now was threatening her life all over again. So she had to go on to a new kind of chemotherapy, and she insisted that she be able to continue to teach through her treatment. And she did. You know, every once in a while we get a call that she needed to put my daughter's lesson off a day or two because she had to go in for one treatment or another. But she kept right on through that year. And then 2 weeks in a row, she canceled the meetings, canceled the teaching sessions. And we knew something was up. And that was when Martin called. He put Peg on speakerphone, and her voice was weak and halting. She took long pauses between sentences. And she said that the treatment wasn't working, that this leukemia was just getting worse. On top of it, between the treatment and the leukemia, her white cell count to fight infection had dropped, and she developed fevers and infection. They then did a CT scan to try to trace where the infection had come from, and they found that her original cancer had come back in her hip again, and now in her liver. It had spread throughout her body. And now she was calling to ask me what she thought she should do. I said, what the doctors say that they could do. And they said, well, not much, she said. They were giving her blood transfusions for her white, for her blood cell counts. They were giving her pain medications. They were giving her steroids. They were not giving her chemotherapy. They said there were no options left. And there were a couple things that struck me. One is that this is the kind of moment that I wasn't sure how we want to answer, how I wanted to answer. But also, this is the moment we debate in this country, really around the world. What is it that we think should happen now? What is it that we want her to do? What would we suggest she should do? Should she go to the doctors and say, what is the possible experimental therapy? Is there anywhere she could go in the country that might be able to try to solve this? Anything with even a lottery ticket's chance? Should she go for, you know, whatever therapy they could offer to try to extend her days and increase the time she had? Or should she, as she said, just give up? Go on hospice, as the doctors were suggesting that she do. They said, you know, to take some comfort care. And what felt to me was, what I felt like was that, you know, these both didn't seem like the options that felt right. That going for everything possible, throwing the kitchen sink at it at any cost, didn't seem right. And just giving up didn't seem right. But it wasn't clear what other options we might have. And it turned out that a good answer was tied to a seemingly unrelated set of work that was done, unrelated research, by a Stanford professor named Laura Carstensen. And she'd done this really interesting body of work where she took people ages 18 to 94 and began studying them over what became the course of 20 years, asking them all kinds of interesting questions. The core of it was that she had these folks carry beepers that she and her team would page every once in a while. And when they paged these folks, she would be asking them about how their lives were unfolding and what they were looking for in their lives as they traversed the course of life, became frail, sometimes dealt with serious illness, sometimes dealt with terminal illness along the way. And what she was discovering is what people seem to experience and what they want. And so you'd get this page on your beeper, and at that moment you were supposed to record, you know, what you were experiencing, what you were feeling, how your health was at that moment. But, it, you know, she was especially interested in what your emotions were. She would also take subsets of them and ask these questions like, if you had half an hour that you could spend spending time with anybody you wanted to, who would you most like to spend that time with? And they would give people a deck of cards, and that deck of cards would have everybody from, you know, members of your family, friends, a movie star that you really like, you know, the singer in a rock band that you love, and ask them to array from who you most wanted to be with to who you least wanted to be with along this scale. So she's been following these folks when they started the study, ages 18 to 94, over the course of what's now more than 20 years, asking these kinds of questions. And what she found was that there are two profiles that people seem to have. There's a younger profile where people are really focused, their desires, their motivations are around doing, getting, having, and achieving stuff. You know, we want public recognition. We want to accomplish great things. We want to make sure we have some visible recognition along the way. And then there was an older signature, which was that as people especially became much more advanced in years, they would tend to not try to have these wide social networks and be connected to lots and lots of folks, but instead focus on a much smaller group of people and be focused on deeper, more intimate relationships. People were less focused on public recognition and much more on just being and being with the people they most wanted, being connected. Intimacy was a really important goal for people. And making a difference for those closest to them was the way that they wanted to make their contribution in the world. Their emotions changed too. And this was an interesting contrarian set of findings that she and lots of other people have made now over many years, which is that as people got older, they got happier. You know, we think that getting older is more miserable in some way, but rates of depression go down. People are the happiest in their lives in their 70s and 80s. Also, emotions become more sophisticated. People become capable of emotions like poignancy, the ability to experience both negative and positive emotions at the same time, that kind of bittersweet that you can feel. Now, this was despite the fact that many of those folks declined in their health and in their abilities along the way. The fascinating thing is that there's a line of argument about why these things happen. In many ways, you would say that older signature is wiser, right? It's less chasing the gerbil wheel, more staying connected to people who really matter. You know, you ask people whether they would, you know, like to spend the evening from midnight to 2 a.m. in a crowded bar shouting to people in order to be heard in snatches of conversation, all in the hope you just might meet somebody new. You know, the young people will array the card saying, that is what I want to do. I do not want to see my mother. And as we get older, we'd say, you know what, there might be nothing more that I'd want than the chance to spend a little time with my mother or my sister. And, you know, forget that bar. Like, why would I ever want to be there? And the puzzle was, why does it take us so long to figure this out? So, you know, there's some thinking that maybe this happens with experience. It takes experience, a kind of learning that occurs in order to accumulate that kind of set of thinking. There was another line of thinking that your brain actually physically changes, that, you know, those emotional capabilities and that kind of way that you begin to think might represent structural changes in the brain as you got older. But Laura Carstensen, the professor working at Stanford, noticed in the cohort of folks that there were some folks who were younger, but this was the era of HIV/AIDS in the early days when the treatments weren't necessarily all that effective. And there was a group of folks who were terminally ill. And she expanded the cohort of those patients because what she started to see was that those folks reported emotions and experiences and desires that were indistinguishable from the old. They could be in their 20s. And they didn't have to have all those years of experience to start to say, you know what I most want is to be with those I'm nearest and most, that are nearest and most dear to me, and be connected to them. And then Laura Carstensen and her team happened to be around on 9/11 doing a study and found that everybody suddenly moved to the older phenotype. That when everybody thought life became uncertain at 9/11, when our lives became fragile, we suddenly didn't want to be in that nightclub. We wanted to be nearer to those that were closest to us and just be. And then 3 months later, forget it. We're fine going back to splitting off in the ways that we do. And it turned out it wasn't that hard to also change what the older, frailer folks thought. You know, she did an experiment where she said, let me take that group of older patients, older people, and say, say that, you know, imagine you got a phone call from your doctor saying, there's been this breakthrough drug that will add 20 years to your life. You happen to have the profile, it's perfect. You have got this drug, and I've ordered it, and it's down at your pharmacy. You just got to go pick it up, and it's there for you. Now, how would you like to spend the next half hour? And suddenly, people took on the younger profile. You wanted to meet new people, wanted to, you know, take on new goals and challenges, get back to getting, having, doing, and achieving, get some of that public recognition all over again. What she was finding was that perspective matters. We all have priorities in our lives besides just existing and living longer. And what those priorities are change depending on how fragile or uncertain or finite you think your life is. Now, the dramatic change over the course of the last century is that we have added 30 years to people's life, much of it through public health and sanitation, but also through adding years of life in the last half century, you know, after age 65, and in many ways improved quality of life, capabilities that wouldn't have otherwise been there. But it's not just that we've had a longer life. The trajectory of life has changed. Prior to the 20th century, illness came on, as one expert on aging told me, illness came on like bad weather. It came unpredictably, and whether you got through it or not, you know, you really didn't know which way it was going to go. There was no clear relationship between your age and your risk of dying. You were at risk of death just being born, being a 5-year-old, being a 25-year-old. You know, George Washington died of a strep throat, and within 3 days he died because we had no treatment for it. There was no necessary connection between being aged and being especially more at risk in life. Everybody was at risk. It was fragile for everyone. And as a consequence, there was closer recognition that there were things that mattered to us beyond mere health and survival. So life was invested with some understanding and thinking about that. A book that I became really fascinated with was by a philosopher named Josiah Royce. He wrote a book in 1908 called The Philosophy of Loyalty. And what he was trying to think about is why do people think that just being safe and well-fed and alive and comfortable, why does that feel insufficient for most people? Why isn't that all we want in the world? And he believed that there was an intrinsic human need to live for something beyond ourselves. And he called that thing that was larger than ourselves that we wanted to live for, loyalty. It was our own personal loyalty. It might be to our own family. It might be to country, to our country, people willing to sacrifice themselves for the country, for an ideal, for God. Whatever it was, it mattered to us beyond the value of our own personal comfort and existence. And he contrasted that with an individualist view. The individual's view is that your self-interest comes first. And sometimes it's cast in sort of cynical terms that in our heart of hearts, if you really poke people and look at the way they behave, it's just their self-interest that matters. You know, it's the economists saying, pay people more, and that's what they do. But then Royce pointed out lots of little instances where, in fact, we violate that idea all the time, or we have beliefs that violate that idea that are fairly intrinsic and there right under the surface to be grabbed at. For example, he asked, why do we care about what happens to the world after we die? For example, if you were told that the world was going to explode, blow up, and everybody you know in it, everybody in the world, were to disappear in this giant explosion, if that happened 1 hour after you died, how would you feel about that? Now, if you were genuinely self-interested, that your life was the only thing that mattered, then it wouldn't really matter much at all. But to most people, it would matter a great deal. It would feel like your whole life had been meaningless. And that's where you begin to see that there are priorities in people's lives besides just living longer. Now today, what's interesting is that we have added time onto our lifespan, but we're living as if we're largely immortal. One of the striking things Laura Carstensen also found was that if you know you have about 20 years of life or more ahead of you, you basically feel like you live as if you are going to live forever. You know, beyond that time horizon, it's hard to conceive of worrying about, you know, your mortality. So basically, you know, we live in a time where prior to, you know, 65, even at age 65, you can expect, if you've made it to 65, that you will live to age 83 on average if you're a male, or an age 86 if you're a female in a society with modern conveniences in the healthcare system. And so even then, you can feel as if you're still immortal. You don't have to worry that your life is fragile, uncertain, finite in any way. And so we spend most of our lives unaware of these larger ideas. We stay focused on how do I get my piece of the world, achieve my particular goals. And we see a good life as being dependent and equivalent to having independence and good health. That those are the prerequisites of what a good life is. And it doesn't fit at all with weakness, with frailty, with aging, with sickness, with being limited by even a terminal illness. Our medical goals are therefore focused on the elimination of those problems, the elimination of aging, of frailty, of mortality. Our institutional focus, whether it's in the places that care for people who are facing those kinds of problems, old age homes, senior living facilities, or hospitals, our institutional focus is on health, safety, survival. They come first. They're presumed to be everybody's first priority. And the result is that we who work in those places are kind of lost when those goals are no longer possible. And one consequence is real suffering. I've been in practice in surgery for just over a decade now, and I've always puzzled over what it is that I might be doing better when I know I've got someone with an ultimately terminal condition. And we will fight in round one and round two, but as you start finding that we might not be able to beat this problem, we sort of don't know what the goal should be then. You feel as if you failed, or at least as if my skills are irrelevant now, and what else is there for me to do? And I think we've lost sight of the fact that people have ideals, have priorities bigger than just surviving in the world, that well-being for people is more than just their safety and health. And you see us missing this point, for example, when we look at what happens in the way that old age homes are designed. They're designed to, you know, when you visit, they will say to you, don't worry, your mom or dad will be safe. That these will be places where they, you know, we've got great health facilities here. But they don't talk about whether they'll be lonely or have no sense of purpose or have connections in their community that they will have lost. You see it in some basic examples like, you know, they're built, when you visit these places, they're built, they look like hospitals nowadays. They're built around a nurse's station. I visited places that are now built by these sort of pioneers creating alternative forms of these institutions. Some of them call themselves nursing home abolitionists. Instead of the long hallways with people doubled up in rooms and waiting for their 7 o'clock wake up and then the pill line and then, you know, you get changed in your clothes and so on, they're built instead around private rooms arrayed in a group of no more than a dozen, and they're centered around a kitchen instead of a nursing station. And in that kitchen, there's a refrigerator. And you can go to that refrigerator whenever you want. Do you know how radical that is? You know, it's controversial because the question is that going to be safe? You know, a diabetic might go to the refrigerator and take out a soda. You know, you'll have Alzheimer's patients who are told to be on a purely pureed diet because they don't swallow so well and they could choke. And what's the most common reason that those patients, those people, will end up being written up? Now, first of all, you're living in a place that will write you up. And you get written up for violating the food rules. And, you know, you'll meet people. I met, you know, an Alzheimer's patient who was hoarding cookies. Like, let him have the damn cookies. But this is hard for us to come to grips with. Suppose they have that small chance that they could choke on the cookie. Well, suppose that they don't have any joys that they're living for. And how much does that matter? We have no imagination, I think, that life worth living is possible when your independence might be taken away, when you need help, or when you're sick and have constraints. And we could see it in the hospital with Peg Batchelder, my daughter's piano teacher. She'd been in that hospital for a couple weeks. She was immobilized with pain. She couldn't move beyond getting out of bed. She had become incontinent from the progress of her cancer. She was humiliated. She was suffering. And she didn't know what to do. She had no imagination that a life worth living was possible anymore. I didn't. Her doctors didn't. We have a debate going on in our country, and actually in many countries. It's going on in India, where I visited recently. It's going on in many parts of the world. A debate around whether we should provide assisted suicide. And I think that, you know, given the option of death with dignity, many people in Peg Batchelder's situation would choose it. And I do think that if there is unbearable suffering, that we have to be able to offer an option that people might be able to expedite their death if that is the case. I worry about doing it safely, not making mistakes, because it's not a revocable kind of thing. You know, we have trouble getting gowns and gloves on properly. We're going to get this one right. But in Washington State, where you live, and in Oregon, you've been doing it right now for a while. Less than 1% of the population who dies ends up requesting a prescription for medication that would allow you to end your own life if you have unbearable suffering. So hoops to jump through to make sure you really do have a terminal illness and are suffering and have not got treatable options that could relieve that suffering. And interestingly, about half of the patients who get the prescriptions never use it. That it is often relief enough to know that the option is there if the suffering should get so bad. But I also worry, you know, in India, for example, where this debate is going on, there's no narcotic medication provided for people with cancer. Or for even post-surgical patients, you know, you can have major orthopedic surgery or abdominal surgery and medication won't be provided beyond Tylenol. So, you know, if you had the option of assisted suicide, if you're in terrible pain and no one is giving you morphine for it, some people would choose that way out. And that's where I think what we have to understand is that the goal is not a good death. And it bothers me when I hear that as what people talk about. The goal is to have as good a life as possible all the way to the very end. And that's where our imagination has not gone. I said that one insight from doing the research for this book was that people have priorities besides living longer. The second is that understanding what those priorities are in people's lives, the most effective way to learn what their priorities are is to ask. And we don't ask. Less than a third of the time with terminal cancer patients, for example, in Peg Batchelder's position, do we ask what their priorities are? And some of the reason, I think, is because we have anxieties about confronting these kinds of questions, but I also think we just don't have the words. I didn't have the words to know what do I do. And getting a chance to meet people like Dr. Curtis and talk to palliative care experts and ask them, you're like, can I watch what you do? You know, one of the beauties of getting to be a writer is that, you know, if I was just their colleague saying, hey, can I come follow you around at work? They just think you're kind of weird. But I can say, you know, I'm working on a chapter for a book. Can I follow you around at work? I'm like, sure, come on around, absolutely. So I followed geriatricians, I followed hospice nurses, nursing home aides and others. And the folks who seemed really good at handling these situations had a few questions that they asked. First of all, they asked questions. I thought the job was about like giving facts, like, you know, don't you understand the data? You're gonna die. But their point was, you know, you talk too much. You should be talking less than half of the time when you're sitting down with somebody. As I paid attention, I was talking 90% of the time. And I was just giving people facts and saying, here are the options and the risks and the benefits. Now, what do you want to do? And what their point is that, you know, you ask a few questions, it unlocks what people's understanding is and what their priorities are. So question one they would ask is, you know, what's your understanding of your health or of your condition? What are the goals that you might have if your health worsens? What are your fears and worries for the future? What are the outcomes that would be unacceptable to you? And from that, you understand what their priorities are. So I asked Peg. Not everybody's able to answer these questions, at least at any given moment in time. But Peg was. I asked her what was her understanding of her condition, and she said, I'm going to die. I've been here for days, just getting worse. And I know I'm coming to the end. And she was angry about it. I asked her, what are your goals if time seems short? And she said, I don't have any that I can even see. So what are your fears or worries for the future? And she had a litany. She feared being in more pain. She feared suffering the humiliation of losing more of her bodily control. She feared dying in the hospital, never getting to see and be with the people she really loved and cared about. Now, hanging out with hospice nurses, I met one nurse who helped me understand the way she saw her job. She did not see her job as letting nature take its course or giving up or, you know, making people comfortable. She saw her goal as a contrast between medicine, which normally tries to sacrifice the quality of life you have now and the time you have now for the sake of possible time later, and instead flips it on its head, and she said, my job is to try to see if I can give people the best possible time they can have now, regardless of the consequence for time in the future. And it's a kind of Zen idea, because it would turn out that in hospice trials and palliative care trials, it doesn't shorten your life. when you do this as you reach the end of life. In fact, in many conditions, for example, in a lung cancer population with stage 4 patients who've lived on average 11 months without this, they lived 25% longer when they had people who helped them think through what the key questions are, their key priorities are along the way. And so I said to her that, the hospice folks I met really see it as a goal of trying to make you possibly have, just a good day. So it seemed like a really long time since you'd had a good day. And she said, yes. Yes, it has. And so her husband and I both said that, maybe that's a goal worth fighting for. It's not fighting for more time, and it's not giving up. It's fighting for one good day. So 48 hours later, she agreed to go home on hospice. I had to break the news to my daughter, Hunter, that her teacher would not be teaching her anymore, that she was, in fact, dying. It's hard for a 13-year-old here to hear. She was struck low. She said, would she be able to see Peg? She wanted to visit her, and I said, I didn't think that this was possible. And then I got a surprising call a few days later. It was Peg. And she said if we were willing, and if Hunter was willing, she wanted to try teaching her again on hospice. I mean, neither she nor I, when we were talking in the hospital, thought that anything remotely like that was going to be possible. But when the hospice nurse arrived, her name was Deborah French, when she arrived, she asked her something about what she most cared about in her life, what she most wanted. And, in the beginning, it was just a good day was just trying to figure out how to get on top of all the problems she was having. And so she worked on trying to make that happen. Managing the daily difficulties meant that she arranged for a hospital bed to be brought in and put downstairs in her dining room so she didn't have to navigate the stairs going up and down to her bedroom or the bathroom, put a portable commode right next to it, arranged for, made arrangements for how they would do bathing and dressing. And then worked on with the doctor on the hospice team as well as her as a nurse on what pain medications would finally get things under control. And they increased the amount of morphine she was on, added a drug called gabapentin, then added Ritalin to combat the stupor that the medications cause. And the combination together, suddenly led her anxieties to plummet as the challenges came under control. And the next thing you knew, she raised her sights. Her husband, Martin, said to me, she became focused on the main chance. She came to a clear view of how she wanted to live the rest of her days. She was going to be at home, and she was going to teach. It took a lot of planning and real medical expertise to make each lesson possible. The team had to help her calibrate her meds. The trick was giving her enough morphine to allow her to teach, but not so much that she'd be too groggy or slurred or freak out the kids to make her handle it. And they did that. Martin said that she was more alive running up to a lesson and for the days after than he'd seen her in a long time. She'd had no children. Her students filled that place for her. She still had something she wanted them to know before she went, though. She wanted to be able to say her goodbyes and give her parting advice. I think we of medicine have forgotten how vital such matters are to people as they approach life's end. People want to share memories. They want to pass on wisdoms and keepsakes, connect to loved ones. They want to make some last contributions to the world. They want to be remembered. And this role, many people argue, is among life's most important. This is how life achieves meaning. And I think the way we in medicine have often denied people these moments out of ignorance or obtuseness or neglect is cause for our shame. Peg, however, got to fulfill her final role. She lived 6 full weeks on hospice, Hunter and other kids got lessons for 4 of those weeks. And then they had 2 final concerts. One was a recital with the children Peg had been teaching, elementary school through high school. And the other was a concert with her former students, accomplished musicians from across the country who came together. The concerts were played in her living room, and they played Brahms and Dvorak and Chopin and Beethoven for their adored teacher. A week after that, she went into a delirium, and then a few days after that, she died peacefully in her bed. My final remembrance of her, however, is from near the end of the children's recital. Afterwards, she stood with each child off to the side to give them a few personal words and a gift she'd chosen for them. And I saw my daughter, Hunter, as she took her aside. She gave her a book of music that she'd selected for her that she wanted her to keep and to learn. She wanted her to learn it just for her, she said. And then she had one more gift for her. She put her arm around her shoulder. And then she whispered, "You're special." And that was something she never wanted the kids to forget. Thank you.
So now we have some time to take some questions from the audience. I'd like to remind folks to come up to the mics and ask their questions in the mics. And finally, to keep your questions short and in the form of a question. Thank you.
So I guess mics right up front here. Whoever wants to be first.
I've been in the medical world for a long time and really appreciate your growth. Your visions of things, your articulateness, and your writings are excellent. To put this in a question, I'm asking you, do you think there's a difference between suicide and dying? So that when you say assisted suicide and assisted dying, to me that's very different things. I would like to hear.
I think that with assisted dying, there is euthanasia, which is where the person may not be part of the choice or not. But when they are part of the choice, in some sense, that is the suicide notion. Now, I think it has different valence for different people. In most of the places that are providing assisted dying, it's with that person making that choice about whether they want to expedite their ending or not. And then the circumstances under which you would allow that or not have been sort of carefully crafted in many of the places where that's happened. I think the concern to me is where we see that as sufficient to the task. Assisted living is a lot harder than assisted dying. We've done a good job, I think, in places like Washington and Oregon in being able to make it so that we understand that, you know, providing the capabilities for some meaningful time in that narrow window of space that time has left you can be possible, though it isn't for everybody. And some, you know, it's the unbearable suffering might deserve a chance for that expedited path. But in the Netherlands, which was the first place to really do it, where it's not 1%, but now closer to 4% and climbing. The Netherlands was one of the, although it was the first country in Europe to provide assisted death, it was one of the last countries in Europe to develop a hospice movement and to develop palliative care. And that's the concern, is that if we perceive the goal as a good death, I think we miss out on something. We miss out on the possibility of as good a life as possible all the way to the very end. And I don't think these are diametrically opposed. Sometimes an assisted death is part of having as good a life as possible all the way to the very end. But not if we are depriving people of those kinds of options and that kind of imagination of what a life worth living can be, even under pretty constrained circumstances. Yes.
My question to you is about storytelling. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your evolution as a storyteller. You're telling this story. Have you thought about the story that you might tell about your own mortality?
Hmm. Well, two different things. I'm not sure I can tell the story of my own mortality yet. but my wife and I have had this discussion about our priorities, and what is really interesting is we see it completely differently. The way I see it, if I were reduced to a brain in a jar, you know, and just had some kind of sensory apparatus hooked up to it so that I could communicate with people and get some input back and forth in and out, you know, that would be okay. If I were a healthy-seeming body, though, and my brain wasn't working and I wasn't who I was, then let me go. Now, my wife says, that's just idiotic. She said, if I look happy, that is good enough for me. And what I know is that over time, what we see is people's priorities change with their experience. We adapt, we have alterations, and that it's a sequential conversation. It's not static in time, and that we'll have to be able to follow that along as we go along. Now, on storytelling, though, what, you know, I had not expected that I was going to spend any significant part of my life writing stories and thinking that that's, you know, part of what a doctor does. I had started writing for Slate magazine, which was formed here in Seattle, as many of you know, at Microsoft. And in 1996, when it was launched, Netscape was the browser. Anybody remember that? And, you know, journalists did not see writing for, you know, the Netscape browser where no one was, you know, you measured hits in hundreds of hits for your article. I got hundreds of hits. You know, you weren't going to leave your job doing these other things. So a friend of mine was working there and asked his friends, would you be willing to write for Slate? And that was where I first started writing for the public, because I said, yes, okay, I'll give it a try. And I first started just writing about policy debates and a kind of political column. But it evolved to pulling in more stories to try to make the ideas I understood not just more vivid. What I found over time, and I was being influenced a lot by Oliver Sacks and a series of other writers, Sherwin Newland, who was writing in the 1990s, right around that time, about how we die. Oliver Sacks taking apart case histories, the man who mistook his wife for a hat, and showing that that kind of detailed observation that we learned to do in medicine could be really important as a way to understand the ideas in medicine, and even the science itself, that we'd lost the art of the 19th century case study that could be so revealing. And so although on my science side, we do large-scale trials, and some members of our team here are here today, you know, who are helping us run large-scale trials, you know, randomization in hundreds of thousands of patients to understand what works and what doesn't work, that there is just as much revealing and knowledge to be tested out of, you know, what we'd call stories, that they have truth to them that can be revealed only by capturing the complexity along the way. I've not imagined myself as a fiction writer. I've not run into questions that I felt I could best answer by turning to fiction, but it's possible that I might well end up there in the future, although my editor says that that's when she leaves me.
I was wondering if you could comment about Ezekiel Emanuel's piece in The Atlantic about dying at 75 and how you respond to that.
Yeah, so Zeke Emanuel, who was, you know, a senior advisor to President Obama, the brother of Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff in the White House, the current mayor of Chicago. Zeke is a provocateur. I admire him enormously. I cite one paper that he wrote 20 years ago that influenced my whole idea about what the role of a doctor is. But, you know, he wrote this piece about the idea that he did not want to live past 75, that he didn't see a life that was nearly worth living after a certain point after that, that the opportunities in life would diminish from that point, and profoundly disagree with it. I feel like he's missing out on that whole line of argument and discussion that Laura Carstensen has opened up about how, you know, when you look at it from the vantage point of what you think you will want when you're age 50 or younger or even, you know, 60, that you may not be able to achieve the goals you care about now. And he talked about ideas of, you know, I'm doing my best work now, have the most impact and influence, the most achievement, and it's all those words that have a lot of salience when you imagine your life is immortal and your capabilities are unlimited. But that people, in fact, have tremendous meaning. They find just the goals change as you get older. And I think he's missing out on that frame of perception and what that means and implies. In many ways, I hope my book is an argument for a more imaginative view. I think it falls into that fallacy that we can't imagine that when you might be in a wheelchair and your, you know, memory might become limited and you might be a little bit slower in your processing speed, that in fact you could feel enormous purpose and real connection to the loyalties, the deep loyalties you have in your life. The people who are unhappy at that stage are the ones who end up incarcerated. As, you know, I use that word to mean, you know, end up in homes for the old who really take away your ability to feel like you're in a home and can pursue those purposes and goals. But I think there are lots of interesting experiments. In fact, 2/3 of the book ends up being around how many of those worlds are changing and can be changed.
My mother is 99 years old and lives in an adult family home. And while she's very spry and can move around a lot, her short-term memory is gone. She has dementia. If you give her a bowl of ice cream, she'll eat it with gusto, but if you ask her 10 seconds later, how did you like that ice cream, she will deny that she had any ice cream. And I'm wondering how one could apply the principles about enhancing the end of life, whether they apply to a person with Alzheimer's or with severe dementia. I'm not sure she could answer the questions, for example, that you outlined.
Yeah, I think it takes more imaginative work, but I tell the story of visiting a senior living home in northern Massachusetts that's for the poor elderly, and this incredibly dynamic woman named Jackie Carson, who, you know, has created this whole innovative environment to allow people to stay in their apartments even as they develop quite advanced disability. And so Ruth Barrett, whom I met, you know, was missing 30 years of her life. She thought she was 55 years old. In fact, she was in her 80s. She was in a wheelchair. She had the same kind of memory issues that, you know, what you did one day, she was not going to remember by that afternoon. And yet you could see, and Jackie and her team could figure out, you know, she wouldn't be able to answer those questions directly, but you could observe the answers every day, that she loved being with people, that she enjoyed food, that she loved going out. And so they would arrange that she could go out to her favorite restaurant, which was a TGI Fridays, with a few of her friends. And she'd go out and, you know, she always wanted a margarita. And, you know, hey, that violated every rule. Like, you know, she was diabetic and it had lots of sugar and, like, you know, they let her have the, they tripled up on the Depends and let her go have the margarita. And she had these joys that were available to her. And, you know, there's lots of time that is frustrating and difficult. And then there are these moments of light and joy that was possible in her life. But it took more discovery. In much the same way, it might take that same discovery if you're talking about a developmentally disabled child and what their goals and wants might be and the ways that you'd have to work to elicit those and recognize them. But it was a recognition that for people just being safe and having their, you know, blood sugars checked and making sure they got their colonoscopy and their mammograms, like, that isn't enough of what they're living for, and that you can find some of these possibilities. But it's, you know, an enormous change from the person who was there before. And that's a lot of the pain for the family as much as anybody else.
I think this kind of touches on the same thing. So in the past 3 years, I've lost 3 grandparents all to falls. And in the months and years leading up
to what?
Falls.
Oh, yes.
And the months and years leading up to those were pretty tumultuous. A lot of falls, a lot of in and out of nursing homes, a lot of care at home, a lot of care at nursing homes. And the priority for all 3 of them were really to be at home, to be in their space and be in that place. And so just curious over your research and over your studies in this time of how to create that good life when those priorities are really difficult to meet, and how do you achieve that, you know, in a way that can kind of balance all of that and balance that happiness and let them enjoy that as opposed to it constantly being a...
Yeah, no, I'd describe the story of my wife's grandmother, Alice, who, you know, became increasingly disabled, living in a big home after she'd been widowed for a long time, starting to have some falls, fell down the stairs into her basement, crashed the car into the house across the street, and finally, you know, needed to arrange another living situation, and spent the last 2 years of her life in a nursing home where she was miserable under all of the rules that there were, you know, where walking was seen as a pathological problem because you're automatically at risk of falling. And feeling her life was severely constrained, and fell anyway and broke her hip, and, you know. And that contrasts that with visiting a geriatrician and seeing what they do. And being in their office and watching them take care of a patient who, you know, had 5 different medical problems and 10 different medications, and I looked at her and thought, well, there's this spot on her lung on the chest x-ray, and that could be a lung cancer, and then she's got bad knees, and she's really got some joint pain from that, and, you know, if I had to, you know, there's just way too many things going on, so I had to zero in on one thing, I would focus on, you know, maybe we should do something about the arthritis, or we should do something about that lung nodule. And what they recognized was that, you know what, the most significant threat to this 82-year-old woman was that she was going to fall. And that there were 3 key risk factors for somebody about whether they could fall. One is that whether they're on 4 or more medications, and she was on 5, and that increased your risk of dizziness and dehydration and other things along the way as side effects. That she had some weakness, you know, she didn't necessarily pass the get up and go test, which is can you just get up from a chair and go? And she had some nutritional issues. And you could see when he did the exam that he took special care, spent more time on her exam, on anything else, on her feet, and saw that she had calluses and some poor care of her feet that put her at special risk for falling. And then arranged for the things that could be done that reduce those risks of falling, so that when I followed up more than a year later, she was no longer having falls like she was at home, that she still lived independently in the house that she was in, and that that was the most important thing for not only the length of her life, but the kind of life that she wanted to lead. Now, how much geriatric teaching do we get of these, you know, do we know, I didn't know, what the 3 risk factors were for your likelihood of falling, let alone what to do about them. 97% of medical schools have no geriatric training skills for students. We don't even learn these basic ideas because it hasn't been conceived of as part of our skill set that's fundamentally important. But we know there are things that can be done to address those kinds of priorities.
Dr. Gawande, thank you so much for bringing attention to the problem that I think we can all agree that modern American medicine is not doing a good job of taking care of frail elderly people and people who are dying. And as you mentioned, it's so important for physicians and healthcare professionals to talk to patients and families about what's important to them and help them with advanced care planning so that they get the care that they want. And you may remember, and I think we should mention, that as part of the Affordable Care Act, when that was being written, there was an early provision of it that would pay physicians to have conversations with patients and families about their advanced care planning. And many in the audience probably recall that Sarah Palin characterized that as a death panel. And the Obama administration had removed that provision from the Affordable Care Act. And the problem, of course, as you mentioned, that physicians need to take time with patients. One of the reasons they don't do that, not only are they not well trained, but they're not paid to do that. They're paid to do procedures and surgeries. And the question is, what can we do with our political environment to change that? To start paying geriatricians and palliative care doctors what they deserve so that patients can get what they want.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point. We have had a really polarized debate for the last few years over what's supposed to happen here. And, I think it is legitimately around a great fear that what this is really about is taking away opportunities for people. Because, there's no particular reason people, should trust that this is about a medical community that is really going to be helping them achieve the things that they want to achieve. And so, that kind of a characterization of that kind of work could easily fall upon ground that people would say, I really do fear this could be a death panel. What kind of conversation are we talking about? We're going to pay doctors to talk to me about how I should stop getting the things I want. And so it, as much as it's been about a political matter, I think it's been that it fell upon fertile soil because we had not done a very good job of even being very clear for ourselves about what we would be having that conversation about. But I think that's changing. I think people are sick of death panels. And I've been really struck in just the last 2 weeks by the response to the book. My last book, The Checklist Manifesto, did really well. I was really thrilled about it. It was number 10 on the bestseller list and stayed on for a long time. And this thing, it's going to come out at number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list. I'm beating Rush Limbaugh. I'm beating, like... And that was not in the realm of anything that we were thinking would happen. Being Joe Perry's biography from Aerosmith. So, the idea that these are difficult ideas and that this might be a mass market kind of notion, I think really reflects ground that's been laid for a while now. Just a month ago, the Institute of Medicine issued a 507-page report called Dying in America that laid out all the evidence in tremendous detail about the idea that that people do in fact have priorities besides living longer, that conversations can be incredibly effective, that these conversations are not going to make people more depressed and more anxiety-filled, that that it's worthwhile to make sure that we finance the ability of doctors to have the time to take these conversations, that we have a really skewed financial system where I'm paid incredibly well to offer, a surgical procedure. I did a study with our team where we looked at what your likelihood is of having a surgical procedure in your life. And the week you're most likely to have a surgical procedure is the last week of your life. And the day in your life you're most likely to have a surgical procedure is the last day of that week of your life. And you'd like to have it a little sooner than that if it's really going to be all that helpful. But I'm not, the people who are lowest paid in the system, as you pointed out, are the palliative care doctors, the geriatricians, the people who've really made an art and a skill out of having these kinds of effective conversations. I think we're reaching a point where we have better ideas now and I can articulate better what those conversations that we want to make sure are covered are about. I think it needs to go one step farther, though. I think the role of palliative care doctors and geriatricians and others who have this expertise is to help the rest of the profession make sure they know how to have these conversations well. That means having health systems pay them not only to take the time to see their patients and talk to them, but to look at the quality of the conversations that are being had for the dying in their local health system, and then coaching their colleagues in how they can do better, teaching them, making that kind of commitment, helping students and teaching students about what the skills are along the way. We don't have enough geriatricians, and we won't. We don't have enough palliative care doctors, and we won't. And so it's going to be something that only works if we scale up the skills across the medical population. And it goes finally one step farther. There's no reason these conversations can't be had by family members. And I describe, you know, pushing back on our oncologists when my dad was faced with his chemotherapy options, where we could make clear, well, here are the priorities that really matter. And he could say, here are the priorities that really matter to me. And is the chemotherapy going to take that away? Because if I have a chance at living longer, I want it to be because I can do the things that I want to do. And that conversation was very interesting. But I think it goes wider than just whether we pay for that conversation. And all of that is part of healthcare reform to me.
These two women right here are the last two questions.
Okay.
Spent some time telling us about the different options available for caring for people at the end of their life here in America, and I'm wondering if you've given thought to such patients in low-resource settings, such as like in India, where they don't have hospice, they don't have geriatricians, and they don't have like death with dignity.
Yeah, I did, and part of it was going back and really looking at the history of how we developed our institutional structures, and I've come to think that there are really stages in the development of countries, because India right now is in the midst of that. The book actually starts with the story of my grandfather, who died at 110 in a rural village in India. For the last 20 years of his life, he needed 24-hour care. He was frail. He needed help with bathing, with cleaning. Some memory was fading, but otherwise he was still, you know, reasonably sharp, even into his late 100s. And here he would have almost certainly been in a nursing home. There he was at home. He was still the head of the table at the family meal. He was he still looked after his fields. People went to him for business decisions, for advice on marriages. We were nostalgic for the kind of life that he got to have in his old age. We are nostalgic for it. But it worked only because it enslaved young people. Young women especially. The daughters-in-law. And even the sons. You know, imagine being his sons reaching the age of 80 still wondering when you're going to inherit your land. The progress of an India, a China, a Korea, or of 19th century America, when we had the multi-generational family as the solution to what happens as we get older, the progress of our countries comes from giving young people freedom. Freedom to live where they want, work where they want, marry whom they want. That's the economic engine of our future, cultural engine of our future. And freeing them to not live in a place where your parents rule your lives, your whole life, is crucial to getting to that space. And India is going through that right now. I talked to my relatives, and they would hear how the elderly were taken care of here, and they'd be horrified. They would be, you know, that is crazy. We're never going to have anything where we would abandon our elderly to nursing homes and things like that. Well, guess what the fastest growing industry, healthcare-related industry in India is? It's building nursing homes. Cropping up in the big cities and elsewhere. I visited some for the poor, some for the middle class, some for the rich in India. And, you know, it feels like where we were in the 19th century, as we were going through the Industrial Revolution and the transitions, I saw places that looked just like a Dickensian poorhouse for the elderly. You know, You meet people who have been abandoned by family in parks with Alzheimer's disease because of the breakup of that extended family. And, you know, it's that transition that occurs that in countries as we develop economic capability, first steps are to provide pensions and social security so that being old doesn't mean being poor. And then being able to have the kind of support systems for people as they face the very old age. In the United States in 1945, the average American, so the majority of Americans, died in their home. And the reason why was because people didn't see any real reason to go to the hospital or didn't have the resources to go, but mostly it was because there wasn't much that the hospital had to offer. By the end of the 1990s, we had discovered a huge amount over the course of the century, and people found that there was many reasons why, if you were seriously ill, you wanted to be in the hospital. And at that point, we reached 83% of us died in institutions. A remarkable change in just 50 years. But in the last 5 years, you know, I see these as passages that countries go through. When you don't have resources, you die at home because you don't have the healthcare abilities to be able to take advantage of. Then as you get resources and the healthcare abilities appear, then people begin dying in the healthcare facilities and medicine becomes the solution we had. You know, as the United States had this end of the multi-generational family and people made prosperous lives for the young, we didn't have a plan for the elderly, and we decided, well, medicine will take care of it. And so that's where we ended up going. And as you go to the big cities in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, you know, the hospital is increasingly where the rates of death in hospitals are higher than in America now. But you come out the other end, and as your country prospers, you start caring about quality of life. And the pendulum starts to swing. So in the last 5 years, we now have more than 45% of Americans who die in hospice. Now, it's not off, you know, it could be for a longer period to come to the end, but we're having this experience now. About half of that 45% are in the home and half are in hospice centers outside of hospitals and nursing-type facilities. And that's a sign of, I think, the evolution of how we develop and grow. And I think the passageway for those other countries as well. Last question.
Well, you gave me a great lead-in. I've been that night shift oncology nurse for the last 31 years holding those hands. So actually hearing a physician speak of the things I'm sure many nurses taught you on night shift, it's nice to hear. So with that said, I have also been that nurse who has snuck those pets in and held those hands, and I speak for the population. I've attended the Palliative Care Summit. You know, I've been doing this for years, and the one population that is unrecognized, we speak of death with dignity constantly for the elderly. We do not speak of death of with dignity for children. Mm. I serve the population for children and adolescents and young adults. You say that 40% of people are dying in hospices. Less than 1% of children have hospice care available to them in this country. 56,000 children are dying, you know, every day, and there are no. In this country, we have 2 freestanding palliative care homes for children. The UK has 49. To meet those demographics, we need 242 homes in this country. So I'm building one here in Washington, hopefully. But with that said, because even when I'm in a room with many practitioners and many people who believe in palliative care, believe in quality of life, believe in integrity, nobody talks about death of children. How do we change that? How do we make their voices heard? How do we make their days? You know, our tagline is, if we can't add days to the life of a child, we'll add life to their days. So how do we make that happen?
You've been part of doing it, right? I promised someone that I would talk about palliative care with children, and then I didn't. I'm so glad you did. Let me tell the story of my wife's cousin. Her name is Callie, and she was 12 years old when I got a call from her parents that was like the call from Peg Batchelder. And her parents were calling because, you know, she had developed Hodgkin's lymphoma a large mass had grown in her chest. She'd successfully treated it, we thought, with radiation and chemotherapy. But then it came back. And it's only a small percentage that it comes back, but when it comes back, you know, the textbooks are not very promising about the prognosis. She underwent a couple different kinds of chemotherapy without success. She ended up hospitalized for something like 4 straight months. She had chest tubes coming out of her sides. She was in pain most, you know, many hours of the day. There was not a day that went by that she was not. And when the third round of chemotherapy failed, the options that the family had were whether they wanted to go for, you know, a bone marrow transplant. It was an unproven approach to try to give to her, or go home with hospice. And they called asking what I thought ought to be done. I wrote about it in my second book, Better. And what I wrote about was the fact that I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to offer. I didn't know how to think about it. And in many ways, I feel like this book is my chance to make up for that. You know, I left Robin and Shelley, her parents, with not much except to say, well, you know, what were the risks and the benefits again of the different options here? They, on their own, they made the decision to take her home, and she had a couple weeks at home with hospice. They were in New Hampshire, and they needed to, you know, work with a hospice agency that hadn't really done this before and understand how do you do it for a child just 12 years old. And we got a note just a couple days after Easter that she died and had passed away in peace, and that they'd found some peace in knowing that she'd been able to do that without suffering for those last couple of days, couple of weeks. I feel like the answer now, I know what I would have said to them. I would have said, what do you think is her condition and her health? What are your fears and your worries for the future, and what are Callie's? Because she could tell us that. What are the outcomes that you think would be unacceptable? And I know what they would have said, that she was dying, that their fears and worries were certainly that, you know, they might miss some opportunity that she could live, but that also that there would only be suffering left to the time that she had, and that the unacceptable outcome would be that that would be the way she spent the last of her time. And so without any help, they came to that final decision and had to walk that path on their own with great doubt and great fear and great uncertainty. And that I know we can change because of people like her and people like you. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you value this episode or this series, please share your appreciation by posting a good review. It helps more people find us. Atul Gawande is a best-selling author, a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and a professor at Harvard University. His latest book is Being Mortal. Town Hall Seattle and University Bookstore presented this event on October 20th, 2014, as part of the Civics Series. Sponsors included the Boeing Company, the Real Networks Foundation, and the True Brown Foundation. Thank you again to Anna Tatashev for this recording. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.